This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Raymond Foundation. Today's program was prepared by William Oram with help from Scott Tagey in physics. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:40. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon for the Afternoon Magazine is Henry Frain. Our 2:30 summary of AM 580 news headlines was bumped this afternoon by a little bit, so let's have Tom Rogers' summary now.
With this look at AM 580 news, I'm Tom Rogers. Illinois' economic performance appears to be leveling off, according to a monthly figure. The University of Illinois Flash Index for June checked in at the same level as the previous month, 102.3. Any number above 100 signifies economic growth, but the number has been coming down over the past 12 months. U of I economist Fred Gertz believes it's an indication that the state's economy may not be headed into recession, though he says continued instability in the financial markets or the continued high price of fuel could push the economy worse. The index measures tax revenue for the previous month. The Champaign County coroner says an autopsy confirms that drowning was the cause of a toddler's death yesterday in Champaign. Firefighters say 3-year-old Wyatt DeJesus was found in a pool on Brittany Trails Drive yesterday afternoon. He was pronounced dead at Carl Hospital. Police are still investigating. The coroner's office says an inquest may be held at a later date. The man being sought by authorities as a person of interest in a string of killings in Illinois and Missouri is the father of four children. And the uncle of 28-year-old Nicholas Sheely says his nephew has had run-ins with the law before but doesn't go looking for a fight. Police want to question Sheely on six deaths in the Sterling and Galesburg areas, as well as the deaths of a couple in Festus, Missouri. Urbana voters will not see a referendum question in November asking them about the city's voting procedure. A proposal on instant runoff voting failed to get a majority of support in a town meeting last night. It was turned down on a 98-43 vote, the second defeat for supporters of that process. For the first time, the University of Illinois is the controlling agency for four state agencies that are longstanding campus residents. Legislation passed this spring and signed by Governor Blagojevich has created the Institute for Natural Sciences and Sustainability at the U of I. It includes the Illinois Geological, Natural History, and Water Surveys and the Illinois Waste Management and Research Center. A university official says the change in control will further strengthen the research the surveys have done with the U of I for decades. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
In sports this afternoon, the Wimbledon women's semifinals are set with Venus and Serena Williams still in the running following victories in today's quarterfinals. Four-time champion and seventh-seeded Venus will play fifth-seeded Elena Dementieva. There we go. Two-time champion and sixth-seeded Serena gets wild card entrant Jay Zhengzhi, who is the first Chinese player to reach the final four of a Grand Slam event. The president of the Los Angeles Clippers says his team will be aggressive in trying to convince Elton Brand and Corey Maggette to stay with the team. Both opted out of the final year of their contract and are unrestricted free agents. The NBA has hired recently retired Army Major General Ronald L. Johnson as the senior vice president of referee operations. It's a newly created position to help strengthen the league's officiating programs following the Tim Donaghy scandal. In baseball, the Chicago White Sox will try for a sixth straight win when they face off against Cleveland tonight at U.S. Cellular Field. Todd Wellemeyer will have a tough act to follow when he takes the mound tonight for the St. Louis Cardinals. Last night, Kyle Loesch allowed an unearned run in seven innings of the Cardinals' 7-1 victory over the New York Mets to improve to 10-2 this season. And the Cubs ended a four-game skid with a 9-2 win over the San Francisco Giants last night. Tonight, the Cubs will try to continue that trend when they send Jason Marquis to the mound. He's 6-4 this season, and he'll be up against Giants starter Matt Cain, who's 4-6. That's sports. The flooding in the Midwest has destroyed people's homes and businesses. It's also caused some environmental problems. But reporter Alex Hewer finds flooding can also benefit the environment.
When rivers flood, they can wash pesticides and fertilizers from farm fields into backyards, homes, and even into drinking water supplies. Floods also destroy crops on low-lying farm fields, but those lowlands are fertile soil because of flooding. Sean Jenkins is the director of the Western Illinois University Kibbe Life Science Station. He says floodwaters carry soil and nutrients that benefit crops and wild plants.
A lot of areas you get sediment buildup, which gives more nutrients for the plants, so you can actually have more vigorous growth in certain areas the next year after a flood.
Some of the trees in the river bottomlands along the Mississippi have adapted to frequent flooding. Jenkins says silver maples and eastern cottonwoods can survive in floodwaters for months and then do even better the following years. That's good because trees can help slow the rush of floodwaters when they come again. For the Environment Report, I'm Alex Hoyer.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.com.
General Motors, the nation's largest automaker, was able to retain its traditional U.S. sales lead, even though its sales dropped 18% in June. Toyota, which many analysts expected would scoot by GM in June to take the title, posted a sales decline of 21.4%. In terms of vehicles sold, it was GM 265,937 to 193,234 for Toyota. Both companies were hurt by a sluggish economy and poor sales of trucks and sport utility vehicles. Earlier today, Ford reported a slide of almost 28%. Chrysler has yet to post its June results. But in another sign of the worsening vehicle market, Chrysler has announced production cuts in two plants in the St. Louis area. Ford and GM recently made similar moves. From Michigan Radio, Dustin Dwyer reports.
Sales at Chrysler have been so bad recently, there are rumors that its parent company, Cerberus Capital Management, could be preparing to chop up the carmaker and sell it off in pieces.
Hogwash. Absolutely not being considered at all.
That's Chrysler President Tom Lasorda on a conference call with reporters yesterday. He said that Chrysler will shut down its minivan plant in St. Louis and cut back production at its truck plant there. That will affect about 2,400 workers. Heading into 2008, many in the industry knew that with higher gas prices, fewer people would be interested in big vehicles. What they didn't know was just how high gas prices would get and how fast people would change their buying habits. Eric Merkel tracks industry sales for IRN Incorporated.
The industry just isn't capable of adjusting that quickly to a dramatic shift in consumer demand. $4 gas changes everything.
It's meant a huge drop in truck sales, and Merkel says it keeps many people from considering any kind of new vehicle purchase. U.S. sales results released today will give a clearer picture of the industry. Some analysts are expecting the worst June sales numbers in more than a decade. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer.
The U.S. Department of Defense is the government's largest consumer of petroleum products like gas, diesel, and jet fuel. If it costs $100 to fill up an SUV, imagine what it takes to gas up a stealth bomber. NPR's John McChesney reports on how the Pentagon is handling the run-up in fuel prices.
Here in the U.S., the Department of Defense is the government's largest consumer of petroleum products like gas, diesel, and jet fuel. So if it costs $100 to fill up an SUV, just imagine what it takes to gas up a stealth bomber. NPR's John McChesney reports on how the Pentagon is handling the run-up in fuel prices.
The biggest user of fuel in the military is the Air Force. It consumes 71% of the military's gallons. Those huge aircraft that transport military personnel and equipment all over the world are not economy boxes. Take the C-5 Galaxy, which can carry 135 tons. It gets 0.07 miles per gallon. And the armies on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan aren't driving hybrids. In Iraq alone, the military burns over 1.5 million gallons a day. Lieutenant Colonel Brian Maka puts the Pentagon's fuel expenses in perspective.
Well, generally, a $1 increase in the price of a barrel of oil in the open market translates into an increase for the whole department of $130 million.
Over the last 6 months, oil prices have increased by roughly $50 a barrel. Do the math. That translates into an increase of well over $500 million for just 6 months. The Defense Department prepares its budget 18 months in advance and had no way of predicting that oil prices would increase this much in such a short period of time. Dove Zackheim is a former controller for the Department of Defense.
The implication of that is, since these fuel costs go into what are called our operations and maintenance budgets, those are going to be the budgets that are hit the hardest. The problem is that those are the very same budgets that are fueling, that are paying, rather, for our operations in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's kind of a vicious circle and a very, very difficult one to deal with.
And it's probably not going to get any better anytime soon. Again, Pentagon spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Mako.
We anticipate over the next 3 months that the increase in fuel costs for the department of $1.2 billion.
That money has to come from somewhere. I mean, do you get a supplemental to cover that, or do you take it out of somebody else's hide?
Well, a little bit of both, but we'll likely have to go back and ask Congress for additional funding for it.
In Congress, several senators have proposed that Iraq should start paying for some of the military's fuel costs because of its large oil reserves. Former Defense Department Controller Dove Zackheim doesn't think that's going anywhere.
I'm just not sure that the Iraqi government would respond the way we might hope them to.
Instead, Zackheim thinks the Pentagon will throw its considerable research and development resources into finding alternative fuels.
My guess is that we're going to see something like other cases in the past where the Pentagon forged ahead in the science and technology world because it was impelled to do so. After all, the Internet did start with the Pentagon.
But that kind of research and development takes time. And meanwhile, the meter is still running faster and faster. John McChesney, NPR News.
The U.S. has a long tradition of traveling musicians. Artists of all types hit the road to play in dead-end bars and dimly lit basements, often for little more than gas money. That particular form of payment would be a lot nicer nowadays, except that now fewer bands can afford to go on tour. South Dakota's Charles Michael Ray reports on what that might mean for your local aspiring rock star.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Jay Whalen Porcupine just dropped $50 in gas into a 1995 Chevy van.
$50 gives you 13 gallons, and it's kind of sad because this is a 30-gallon tank.
Porcupine is the frontman for the band The Red Men. In the last 2 years, the three-piece band from Rapid City, South Dakota, has driven about 30,000 miles in this van, hitting small towns and big cities across the country to play a unique version of pop punk, including this fast and loud piece titled This Year's Mono. This song isn't about high gas prices, but after spending $50 on less than half a tank, Porcupine can't help but to look back at the way things were, when a band like his could afford to take its act on the road. He remembers when they could get paid $50 or $100 at a small show and have enough money to make it to the next town.
This kind of lifestyle, this way of life, just might go extinct because of the gas prices, really. It's just, you know, we haven't toured in a couple months, and it's just, we've been really just rethinking the game plan.
A lot of musicians are rethinking their plans. One of them is Minneapolis-based Haley Bonner. The 24-year-old artist is about to release her fourth CD. The title track, Big Star, seems to lament the desire to reach for fame. To promote her CD, Bonner is planning a cross-country tour this summer. Even with new forms of internet marketing, she says going on tour makes a big difference.
It's a good thing to be in those cities as that's happening because, you know, people are hearing your music, hearing your name, reading about you and whatever. It's really the best time to go and do that.
For her upcoming tour, Bonner is budgeting $2,000 just for gas. She says if gas prices continue to go up, she won't be able to afford to tour anymore. The price at the pump has forced some musicians to cancel their tour plans altogether. Others are finding alternative ways to travel.
I'm touring on a canoe from Buffalo to New York City.
Right now, Christopher Bell is touring in California in his 97 Toyota Corolla. But in mid-July, he'll trade his car for a canoe and head down the Erie Canal, hoping to stop and play some of the towns along the route.
I have never done an actual long canoe trip, so I'm planning 20 miles a day, which I've been told by another guy who's canoed the whole Erie Canal that should be fine.
Bell follows in the footsteps of troubadours like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, the kind of musicians who are driven more by the love of music than by fame or money. Bell is optimistic that high gas prices won't kill off touring musicians.
I think it would be a sad day if it did, but people will find a way, and music will get out, people will still see shows.
If you live along the Erie Canal, keep an eye out for Christopher Bell this summer. Maybe he'll play you the song called Oh How We Danced, if that is, his arms aren't too tired from paddling.
Everyone here, it seems, is lost from all the dreams, and all I want is for you to come back to me.
For NPR News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Earth and Sky.
Tuesday, July 1st, 2008. Mercury, the closest planet to the Sun, is the bright planet seen least often.
And that's not because this world appears faint in our sky. Mercury often shines as brilliantly as a bright star. But Mercury is elusive because when it's visible, it's nearly always in twilight, either at morning dawn or evening dusk.
Presently, Mercury shines before dawn. As seen from Earth today, it's reaching its greatest elongation west of the Sun. What this means is that Mercury appears in the east before dawn. The solar system's innermost planet is always bound to the Sun by a short tether. Given clear skies, Mercury might be visible 30 to 45 minutes before twilight begins.
Throughout July, no matter where you are on Earth, Mercury will sit over your east-northeastern horizon before sunrise. With an unobstructed view eastward, chances are you'll spot Mercury about an hour before the sun comes up, within 2 hours of sunup at far southern latitudes like in New Zealand.
At early dawn for the next couple weeks, look for Mercury to hover over the sunrise point on your horizon. Even though this modestly bright world can be seen with the eye alone, binoculars will help you reel Mercury in from the July pre-dawn twilight. I'm Joel Block.
And I'm Deborah Bird for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's broadcast is made.